Welcome to Darby and Friends, 1490 WGCH. And today we have a guest who has been with us before, but today it's with a different hat on. I have Anita Keir, and she is the Reverend Anita Keir, a Protestant minister who has written numerous books, and some of them are in second or third printing by now? Easily,
second.
I was
second. This is the third.
Third
actually.
Printing, yeah. And which was your first book?
Curriculum.
Curriculum. So the Mustard Seed series was.
That was back in the 1980s.
And this is geared mainly for children.
This is gained for children, except the pre-confirmation-confirmation series could also be used with adults because they will answer the questions differently from what a youth person would because they have different experiences and different questions.
Right. Now, was that the research you did for that and the work on that what sort of planted the idea for resurrection dialogues? Or did that come out of some other place?
That came out of, I had for 3 years, I ran a seminar with about 20 people in it, asking the existential questions. It's not just on resurrection, it's on who is Jesus, what's going on today, what are the different theological and philosophical approaches to religion that people are confronted with today, because everybody's asking questions, and platitudes don't work.
Right.
For some, platitudes work. But questioning people, platitudes do not work.
Right.
So, and then I had an unpublished work that I had finished in 2010, and then my husband died, and I never got around to publishing it. And then only this year, at the beginning of the beginning of 2014, I got back to my writing, and the Greenwich branch of the National League of American Pen Women we have critique sessions once a month, and they said, Anita, it's too complicated. Your work is too complicated. You've got to simplify it and break it into a couple books, because if you have a big volume, people are not going to read it. And the interesting part is, you know, one-third of this book is from a Jewish perspective. And I have a Jewish friend who said, Anita, your dialogue isn't right. And she came and helped me develop my dialogue for my book. I mean, it's incredible because I'm really trying to show how we are, that the Christian church is really an outgrowth of the Jewish faith and show the connection between mm-hmm. both faiths.
So if I'm understanding what you're saying, the characters, because you have a whole cluster of people that you, they almost become your friends as you sit and reading it of what this one thinks and what that one thinks. They're fictional compilations of people that you have heard talk and express themselves.
Exactly.
And you've put them into a context of, and yet there was one when I was reading at the beginning, I said, oh, I think I must know that person. I remember that incident in Greenwich at the Catholic Church.
You know, I have a couple of Catholic friends that said, you know, who I gave them an early copy of this, and they said, Anita, am I married in your book? I said no, but then I figured, well, I must be right on.
Yes, yes. Oh, I can very definitely, if not totally the person, I can see people that I'm very much reminded of, which is always fun when you live in a town. So you decided that through this book, which is the format is people sitting in a group talking, that you could give what?
Well, I'm trying to do, this book basically is a Christianity 101. It's a primer. You don't have to be of any particular faith denomination. You can be an atheist looking at the book and reading
Thomas.
It.
Thomas, the character, yes. Thomas, yes.
But he's a mystery character in many ways. And in my next book, he's even going to be more mysterious because of things that have happened in his life, which he hasn't divulged to anybody.
Uh-huh.
So he will be my most developed character. But the These are created characters out of my mind, and it is based on they're a composite of people that I know. And also, you know, I read what's going on in contemporary religion these days, and I'm trying to give the point of view of some of the theologians, modern theologians and historians, and what they're espousing to the public. And some of it is not legitimate, I think. You know, it's just, you know, the problem is the academics talk to the academics. The theologians do not often speak in lay terms. I'm trying to do this book in lay terms for the people outside of the church who have a lot of questions but don't want to go into the church because they're afraid that they'll have the love bombs on them and stuff like that. You know, it's really something for, there's something there for everyone.
Yes. For me personally, I really enjoyed how you took pieces of information and created links that you could understand that when, this is just in the early part, the Paul, St. Paul, he was Jewish, but he had a Greek education, so he was extremely intellectual. Mm-hmm. His understanding of resurrection was different from what we understand as the term resurrection, which is different from Jesus rising Lazarus from the dead.
Right.
Because those, you know, in
right.
your head, you say, well, they all were, you know, right. talking about dead people who were no longer dead. So what's the difference? But you bring that out.
Yeah, because Lazarus would die again. Mm-hmm. Jesus did. Christians do not believe that he died. You know, he died, but he lives where Lazarus does not live.
Right, right. And the fact that some of the Jewish sects believed in a concept of resurrection, but a different kind of concept.
Well, they differed again, too. I think I showed in the later part of the Jewish section of this book that you have the Reform, the Conservatives, and you have the Orthodox, and you have the Reconstructionists. I mean, their beliefs are all over the place. But the traditionalists believe as the Pharisees believed, and that's Rabbinic Judaism, where there is a resurrection, but contrary to what Paul experienced and the early Christians, they believe there will be a general resurrection. And some Christians believe that too, where others do not. They believe that it's immediate afterwards. But Paul's Jewish background influences a lot of his theology.
Yes, very definitely so. So that was one of the things. And then the character Mary as a Roman Catholic very literal in some ways, where she says, God created the universe and everything in it simply by voice command. Well, sitting here with my own theological sense of things, you know, there are a lot of very big thoughts going on in 2015 that the world is created by thought and what you speak.
You're talking about epistemology, you know, how do we know something? That's a very complicated subject.
Yes.
And I think that that plays a part with postmodern thinking.
Exactly.
And but we shouldn't be seduced by it. I mean, do we live in a closed universe or an open universe?
Isn't that a wonderful question?
You know, and I will deal with that in my next book, but not this book. You know, I can't, you know, I couldn't cover everything.
Right. Would have been too large a book.
Too large a book.
I also think it's very nice the way you go through each chapter having a particular a theme. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you have thoughts and questions to be contemplated. And,
for each chapter.
Yes.
The reason I did that was so that Bible study groups or groups that want to form in a home that want to discuss this book, you don't have to be a theologian to ask these questions. It's for lay people to discuss their point of view. And I've tried to create a non-threatening environment that also educates the lay person.
And also educates, but also
informs them.
And draws them into conversation.
Because
you can't learn anything if you don't discuss it.
Right.
Which is just, I think, fantastic to get people talking about it.
Right.
Another point that I thought was made that I thought was very interesting, that the resurrected Jesus appears and he's sometimes recognizable, but not always recognizable.
That's a puzzles everybody.
Yeah.
But again, in fact, I was asked that question a couple nights ago by somebody, and I said, well, you know, it's a different mode of existence. It's a mystery to us. We don't know how to handle that.
And you've written Parents' Guide to Prayer.
Yeah.
And your newest book is Resurrection Dialogues with Skeptics and Believers. Now, what, you know, we always, when you're reading any book, you get favorites. Now, my favorite character is Edward. I like the way Edward thinks.
He's good.
Yeah, I like Edward.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he brings up stuff I'm always thinking about. I was raised a cradle Episcopalian, and, you know, it was all right one, and it was a real point of view. And then you get to college, and you meet people of other faiths, and other everything is different suddenly, and you go, well, I've always thought I was right. How could I be anything but right? And then you realize they think they're right too. And you go, oh, and now I've just met a scientist who says we're all wrong.
Well, he doesn't say that.
No, but he brings into play quantum physics, which has to give you pause to think about the universe in a different light.
He actually is based on my husband.
Oh!
Who had a scientific background. And you know,
he must have been a great guy.
He was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, I recorded all these sessions. I have 66 hours of tapes. And I can hear, I looked for it maybe a couple months ago. And there's my husband's voice. And he's always talking about the scientific aspect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's the challenge in the 21st century.
Very much so.
How do you marry your belief in science and all the really fascinating, exciting things, and yet still feel you can hold on to your faith?
Yeah, and it started with Newton and Galileo, that we no longer are the center of the universe, which we thought we were.
Exactly.
And I think that we can't let science undermine our faith, because they're two different disciplines. I mean, science can't experiment to see whether you're going to rise from the dead or you're not going to rise from the dead, or they can't say, why do you love somebody or why do you hate somebody? Each discipline has its own limitations, but each can help inform the other.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's interesting. So as we go through, you also offer up for anyone who is interested in expanding their understanding and their reading different authors and things at the end of each chapter of people you've mentioned in terms of...
Well, they're found in the notes at the end of the book.
Yeah, well, here, do you agree with Hans Kuhn?
Right.
And then there's another with a German name that was impossible to pronounce, Schlettenreiter or something. You know who I mean.
Yes,
that name.
Schleiermacher.
So, I mean, you're reading along, and it's very interesting, the conversations, and that could be enough. But if you say, well, that was sort of an unusual concept, I want to know more, the information is there for you to take that kernel and take the next step. So for me, I don't like to just be left with, okay, this is what everybody's saying, done. I want to know what's the next step so I have a choice to take it.
Well, you're like many of us, where you look at doubt as an invitation to think.
Mm.
You know, and that's exactly what you're doing.
Yes, definitely.
And that's what I'm hoping most people will do.
Yes. I think this would be just a super book for not necessarily just a Bible study, but for a book group. Read
definitely,
it.
Definitely.
Take it and explore
tear it apart.
It.
You know, yeah. See what people believe, what they don't believe, and why. You know, yeah. I think it's good to question our doubts because that is the pathway to belief.
Yes. Yes.
Maybe for some people, maybe not yes. for others. So.
Well, at least it crystallizes where you stand,
right,
which is important.
And it's an informed decision. It's not based on ignorance or lack of information.
Exactly. In another chapter, you talk about the Bible is like a telescope. If a man looks through a telescope, he sees worlds beyond. But if he looks at his telescope, then he does not see anything but that. The Bible is a thing to be looked through to see that which is beyond. But most people only look at it, and so they see only dead letters. I thought that was really interesting. And I was thinking about, from where I sit, the Bible is a map for life.
Very good.
It's
well,
a
that's
map.
What that cover is all about.
Yes.
Because you see there's a bell buoy there.
Yes.
It's the ocean, you have the sky, you know, light, and you have darkness, mm-hmm. and I'm telling you to go on a journey.
Yeah.
And there are navigational aids. The Bible is your it's sort of like your GPS.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So, you comment in here, you see, God may liberate us, but God requires us to do our part. Do you think that's hard for people?
I think so. I have, it's very interesting, I have a born-again sister-in-law.
Just before we went to break, we were talking about the religious is not scientific. It's trying to explain the riddles of life, creation, life, death, sin, judgment, pain, toil, evil, and God may liberate us, but God requires us to do our part. So you were just getting ready to tell us about your sister-in-law.
Well, back in the early 1980s, my sister-in-law had a born-again experience. She was going through a divorce, and that may have made her susceptible to suggestion or whatever. And everything that she said, the Holy Spirit even had charge for a water tank. I mean, it got so ridiculous that when I was in seminary, I thought, how do you counter this, that the Holy Spirit does this for you, the Holy Spirit does that for you? And I thought, you know, I didn't know how to argue against what she was saying. And even to this day, she really is not living out the gospel message. She lives in Australia, and she still spouts platitudes, and there's that self-righteous attitude. And then when I talk about all the people fleeing horrendous conditions in their home country, arriving in Australia, she wants to send them all back. What does that
God's have love.
To, yeah. What does that have to do? I mean, you know, to me, that is tells me how shallow her faith is, and she hasn't thought it out. What does the gospel require? And the Jewish people have the same requirements. It's not like it's just Christian. Jewish people believe that you have to make it a better place. And, of course, the Jewish people were barred from exiting, getting out of Germany or getting accepted in other countries.
Mm.
And it's the same thing that happens when you exclude people whose lives are in danger from seeking a safe haven.
Mm. Mm.
And to justify sending them back into horrendous conditions.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of problems with that.
Most definitely. Moving on to another chapter, you talk about Israel's prophets were the conscience for its people. Mm-hmm. Do we have a postmodern 21st century prophet or prophets that are our conscience?
Well, that's an interesting question. We have a lot of people that show our deficiencies politically and maybe philosophically and theologically, some, but they're not necessarily well known. And I think there are a lot of people that use Jesus or their beliefs as to legitimate their thinking, whether they take into consideration all the complexity of what's going on. It's not straightforward. There's no black and white here.
Would you say those oftentimes are cultish kinds of leaders that call themselves modern-day prophets and follow me and do this, this, and this because I know the future?
Well, there's a lot of that. Definitely, and I'll have that in my next book.
Aha! So that's a real stay tuned.
Yeah,
good. When we're looking at the Bible as a book, and the certainly the Old Testament importance of the individual's relationship to God, it's still, you can have your personal relationship, but it can't be separate from the collective nature of we are, in the case of the Old Testament, we are a body of people
right. Who
move and do things in a particular way, and we have rituals that commemorate this collective history. Is that something that is more difficult for Christians because we have so many different ways of expressing this collective sense of identity? You know, a Catholic is different from a Lutheran, is different from an Episcopalian, is different from a Unitarian, is different from...
You have a very valid point there. But there are groups, I mean, you have National Council of Churches, and you have other ecumenical groups, and you have the Interfaith Council of Fairfield County. They're all trying to work collectively to make the world a better place and to develop understanding, and they're not trying to impose their worldview on you. So there are organizations, whether they're prophets or not, no, they're not prophets. We live in a different time, and the prophets really were not. We have prophets of atheism, and we have prophets of hedonism going on all the time. All you need to do is watch TV or turn your internet on, and you'll see all this divergence. I mean, it isn't a collective mentality.
Mm. Right.
But you do have collective mentality sometimes when groups isolate themselves from the rest.
Well, what do other people think about this? One of which is, does evil exist?
Oh, very definitely. But can that's the eternal question. Why does the good God allow evil to exist? And then the Gnostics will say, well, it's a battle between God and Satan. Is it? That's a simplistic answer. And I've asked myself that question many times, and I can't come up with a satisfactory answer. The only thing I do think about is how we allow evil to grow and don't stop it, such as the Ukrainian invasion takeover. My husband was from the Baltic states. And, the Russians are massing their troops along the border of those Baltic states and Poland. And, you look at the spread of ISIS and what they're doing and the horrors they are inflicting on people. Why do we allow that to exist? And if you stop it, you create other evils, if you go to war. Mm-hmm. Because war is evil, too.
Right.
So it's not an easy question. And can you blame it on God? Especially, a lot of people that don't believe in God, blame it on God.
Yeah, that's kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Could it possibly be that there isn't, to me, God is an entity. I don't see, personally, Satan as a separate entity that is, I'm not watching a movie of God fighting Satan. I wouldn't give Satan that much power. But I could accept Satan is the ego within myself and within others that's not doing the right thing, not following the golden rule, not being aware that love is the most important, not eros love, but agape, to spread in the world. Right. I see it
that's
more.
That's a good analysis. Very good. And in fact, Satan is really our attempt to incarnate evil. Satan is not an individual. If you want to talk about Satan, you could talk about Hitler, incarnation of evil.
Right.
But and artists have portrayed Satan in many different renderings, and so.
But I don't think there really is, you know, the red horns and the tail,
no.
And then
that's an artist's rendition. Rendition.
And I think that almost is the joke. It simplifies. It makes it funny, or makes it Halloween cute, or something.
One of the things that Einstein even said, evil is the absence of good.
Mm.
And if God is not in people's hearts, then we may have, although we have some very good people that don't believe in God, but as you say, the ego can take over, and who knows what boundaries are there.
Right. If any.
If any.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because there's no stop. There's no filter.
Right. Right. Or no, yeah, right. No boundaries.
Yeah. So you also, in part three, you bring up the fact that there is a common ground between Jews and Christians. And I think particularly with the way the world situation is right now, that that's very important for people to see connections more than they see differences.
Right. Right. And as you notice, I use Bart Palos' suicide as a good example that ties us all together, that we are all sinners, and how do we define sin, and where does the responsibility lie when somebody is bullied and they can't take it anymore and they commit suicide? Who pulls the trigger? It's not the victim, it's the other people. And then there's moral injury here that's mm-hmm. going on, and nobody is stopping it. And I think that we need to realize what has happened to the bullies. Where is their soul, and in what state is it in?
Mm, what caused them to become
and
angry?
Right. And why did they have to join the gang?
Mm.
You know, they also are victims of being bullied. Either you go along, or you're going to be ostracized, like ostracize Bart.
Yeah.
So I think that evil is sin. We all are sinners, and if we deny we're sinners, then we're
pretenders.
Pretenders are in denial. Yeah,
those are some heavy concepts.
But that joins all humanity together. That's why I put that between the Jewish section of the book and the Christian section of the book.
In terms of the Bible, there are people who say, well, I read it in the Bible, so it's so. What do you say to someone who says that?
I do not believe in having anything taken out of context and blow it up to something that was never intended. And you have to have an understanding of how the Bible even came into existence. I think I have it there someplace, that started as oral traditions back before the year, you know, from prehistory. And then King David had scribes go out to the tribes to record the stories, simply because the tribes were going from an agrarian situation into an urban situation. So they had, you know, David thought these stories would be lost. So they went to all the tribes, and they had these storytellers who memorized the stories and told it to everybody. And so a lot of the stories in the Bible were pieced together from many different tribes, and it was never meant to be taken literally.
Well, I've just told Anita I may kidnap her and keep her to continue to talk with me, because I've got gazillions more thoughts and questions. And one of them, she's going to have to come back, because if we started with the question I have, what's the difference between a suicide bomber and a Christian martyr, we'd be here for another 2 hours. So we're not going to talk about that. But because the name of the book is Resurrection Dialogues with Skeptics and Believers, I wanted to sort of wrap up. Obviously, the miracle of Jesus's resurrection, because it was certainly different from traditional religious Jewish resurrection stories. It had a whole nother way of taking us to think about what happens, and to whom does it happen? And then here we are in the 21st century. The question comes up, well, that was over 2,000 years ago. What does that mean to me? What do we think about that?
Well, as I say in the book, that it you can't keep Jesus in a tomb. You can't control him. We can't let people tell us what it's all about. We have to think it out for ourselves. There will be suffering and death. And nor do, you know, we have to think in terms of the Crusades. Even I don't even think I brought this up in the book. But you know, to say that you have a Christian duty to go in and pillage Arab lands, I think that is a big mistake. You know, to follow people, blind, you know, quote, leaders, you know, they set themselves up as leaders. ISIS does it, some of the other groups, and to follow them blindly, I think, is a big mistake. And nobody can tell me that if I'm a suicide bomber that I'm going to go to heaven once I do my mission. And it shows how people have been brainwashed, intimidated, indoctrinated, and I think that indoctrination is not education, and we have to deal with that.
So do you think that resurrection is still the most vital piece of Christianity?
Yes. Yes. It's the linchpin for Christianity, definitely. And but then we have the different people's interpretation. Now, you may have some historians who investigate the early stages of Christianity saying, well, it was a spiritual resurrection, not a bodily resurrection. Or
and then all those people had a corporate hallucinatory experience of seeing.
Right, they'll say that. And you know, even in early Christianity, you had alternative Christianities, beginning with the Ebionites or the Adoptionists, that Jesus was adopted at his baptism, that, you know, the Holy Spirit adopted the man Jesus.
So that would negate the virgin birth.
Definitely. Then you have the Marcionites and the Docetists, which they say Jesus entered the world as a spiritual, non-material being and only seemed to be human. And a lot of people take that position. Then you have the Gnosticism, based on the Nag Hammadi cache that was found in Egypt, you know, with those documents, and a lot of people think that they should be added to the New Testament. They're actually
another
books.
Apocrypha.
Yeah, exactly. They're requesting, a group of people are requesting that at least 10 of the Gnostic Gospels with their numerous deities, I don't even know who they are, that these deities, that be added to the New Testament and be called the New Testament. So you have...
But there's only one God. That's the thing that is so weird,
right,
in my head.
Right.
I mean, there's only one. And
yeah.
it
And we have to I'll deal with that in my next book.
I can hardly wait.
Well, it'll take me a while, but it's Trinitarian theology. How do you explain, I sort of have problems with people. Well, anyway, we have to deal with how can we have the three in one.
Excellent. And I can hardly wait for that to come out. Wow, what an afternoon. I feel like I've had nourishment for the brain. I'm thinking about so many different things, and it's wonderful to have a book that anyone and everyone can read. It's very clear. It's lively. The questions that come up are just amazing. And it doesn't tell you what to think. It invites you to think. What could be better than that? So if you're part of a book club or if you have a Bible study, I highly, highly recommend Resurrection Dialogues with Skeptics and Believers by Anita Keir.